The BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the programme and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are Anne Scott James, Dennis Norden, Dillis Power, and Frank Muir. Round one tries to test their respective vocabularies. 2 marks if they get the answers right. We begin with Anne Scott James. Anne, what is hydrolysis? H-Y-D-R-O-L-Y-S-I-S, hydrolysis.
Well, something to do with water.
Yes, that's fair enough.
Now, electrolysis is some sort of curing by electricity. I think it's some sort of water cure.
No, it wouldn't cure you.
Wouldn't cure you.
No, it's some kind of scientific process.
Well, water and chemistry, you put those things together, give you 1.5, which is fairly generous, I think. Hydrolysis is the chemical decomposition of a compound by reaction with water, and the water, in case anybody's interested, also gets decomposed. Frank,
yeah.
What is a gadoid?
Gadoid. It's the opposite of a sadoid. It's a piece of Maria Martinui or Sweeney Todd'um. It's a gadoid, like to get my hands on that maybe.
No,
gadoid is a creature.
Yes, creature.
All oids are creatures, aren't they?
Yes, that's right. It is a creature.
Water. It's a water creature.
So it's a. What?
Water. It's a fish.
Yes, a fish. And a well-deserved half mark. A gadoid is a fish of the cod family. Dillis Power, what is a champagne? C-H-A-M-P-A-I-G-N.
Kind of open-air piece of ground. Kind of thing that Agincourt was fought over.
Hello. 2 marks. Champagne, in this sense, unlike Veuve Cliquot, is an expanse of open country. In fact, it comes straight from the Italian Campania. Dennis Norden, what's the meaning of noctivagus?
Well, that's a compound of nocturnal and vagrant, I guess. I would say that if you booked into a strange hotel and you neglected to find out exactly where the bathroom was situated, you would find yourself noctivagus.
Yes.
Which would be wandering round at night.
You're absolutely right, then. This couldn't be better. That's the perfect definition. 2 marks. Now, before we begin round two, I give each team a quotation for them to write down, and I hope that the two women members team will go on studying those quotations, because at the end I shall ask them where the quotations come from. The one for Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden is "Forever Amber," and Dillis Power and Frank, yours is "My love is like a red, red rose." And then at the end of the program I shall ask Dennis and Frank to give me their idea of how these came to be said or written. Well, then we have a round of origins and derivations of words and expressions and phrases, and 3 marks if members of the team can first of all give me the present meanings and then the derivation. Beginning again with Anne Scott James, and the phrase "to run riot."
Well, to run riot just means to go berserk,
mm-hmm.
Go mad, nuts, create trouble and confusion.
Yes, and by origin? You've got to think about Jorrocks.
Hunting.
Ah, it's a hunting word.
Oh,
it's
right.
What the hounds do when they're not behaving themselves properly.
Yes, and why aren't they behaving themselves?
Because they are not coming to heel, keeping to the scent.
Yes?
Yoixing, tally-hoing. They are just going all over the woods like that.
Yeah, all right. 2.5 out of 3. I did some help there. Present, run riot means acting or even to talk without any kind of control, a very disorderly way and very, very wildly. But it is a hunting term. When the hounds had lost the scent, they then may lose their sense of direction and go all over the place, running riot and following any kind of scent indiscriminately. That's jolly hard for a huntsman. 2.5. Frank Muir, spit on it for luck.
Spit on what for luck?
That's what you've got to find out.
Well, it's just a gesture of old-fashioned belief that the devil is lurking at hand, ready to snatch you. And spitting on something of your own propitiates the devil.
Yes?
You spit on your hands, yes, before digging, but that's for practical purposes, because it, yeah, tends to prevent blisters.
Yeah, that'll do, Frank. That's 3, I think.
You spit.
Oh. Expression, spit on it for luck, still used, I think, by country people, and I believe by people in London. But it goes right back to Greek and Roman time. Pliny said it averts witchcraft and availed in giving the enemy a shrewder blow if you spat on fist or on weapon first. And people do still spit on money to bring them luck. Boxers spit on their hands. And it's said that costermongers spit on the first money that they receive during the day. But Frank, I think, is quite right, because there is a perfectly practical origin behind this. And those of you who may have read The Naked Ape will realize what it is, that if you are girded up for action, your palms tend to sweat. And if they don't sweat in time, as when a woodman is using an axe, it's not a bad thing to assist the process of sweating first. 3 marks. Dennis Powell, subpoena.
Subpoena means when you're waiting to be called as a witness, I thought, doesn't it?
So you have to be a witness.
Well, you have to be. You're compelled to be a witness.
Yes, but what is the thing that makes you go as a witness?
Well, you're under a penalty.
Yes, that's perfectly true, but how do you know?
How do you know? Mm. Well, you know if you didn't go.
Yes, but how do you know?
I see. Oh, you're fined.
Mm-hmm. Yes, all right, I've got 3 marks.
Sorry.
What I was trying to get exactly was a subpoena is a writ commanding somebody to appear in a court of justice, often very unwillingly, to bear witness or to give evidence in a particular case. And as Dillis implied, it's called subpoena, 2 Latin words, because these are the beginning of the writ, subpoena centum librorum, which means under penalty of having to pay £100. 3 marks. Dennis Norden, bald as a coot, or silly old coot.
Well, it means you're very bald or very silly.
Yes.
Well, a coot is a bird which hangs around brooks.
Yes.
I come from haunt of coot and tern. I can only presume that a coot is both bald and silly.
Well, that's not at all a bad shot. I give you 2 out of 3. Quite common expressions, although they come from America originally. The so-called bald coot is called bald, not because it is, but it has a very odd kind of bill or beak, which grows back right towards the middle of the forehead, and then forms a kind of bone shield. And from a distance, this poor old coot does look quite bald. In fact, it is not. And silly old coot, or daft as a coot, comes from American hunters who had, at any rate, the impression that a coot used to put its head into mud or water because, poor thing, it thought that if it couldn't see itself, you couldn't see it either. But I don't think ornithologists would think that was a very good explanation. 2 marks. Well, then we have a round of who, why, and what questions. 2 marks, again, for correct answers. Anne Scott James, who wrote a historical novel called The Last of the Barons, and who was the character referred to in the title?
Well, it was written by Lord Lytton.
Yes.
Who was the character?
He made kings.
Oh, Warwick. The Earl of Warwick.
Right. Bulwer Lytton, who at one time, which I never knew before, was Secretary of State for the Colonies. but was otherwise a novelist, wrote a number of historical novels, including The Last Days of Pompeii, and this was one he wrote about Warwick the Kingmaker, dealing with the Wars of the Roses. Frank Miller, what do you know about hellfire clubs?
I know something about a hellfire club.
That'll do.
I presume the others were named after that one.
Yes.
Well, there's this chap, you see, Sir Francis Dashwood, who's a bit before 1760, but not all that much, who did the grand tour and had a bit of religious mania, actually, in Rome. I think it was Rome or Florence, and went altogether to the reverse and rushed back to England and bought Medmenham Abbey on the banks of the Thames, where it still is, or ruined, though, albeit, and set up there this tremendous orgy club for holding unimaginable goings-on. And it was called the club because it was a kind of club, and they all dressed up as monks, so it was all mixed up with sacrilegious goings-on as well.
Yes, that's quite right. I've got absolutely nothing to add, except that they were also known as the Franciscans. This is the point Frank was making. An unwarrantable affront, not on Frank, but on the Franciscan order, of course. All right, Dillis Powell. The origins of Jocasta and the Famished Cat and of the crime of Sylvester Bonnard were both found in France. But which France, and in what sense wasn't it the true France? And what were they anyway?
We'll take the seventh question first.
The crime of Sylvester Bonnard was a novel or story by Anatole France.
Yes, that's quite right. And the other one, too?
The other one, too.
Yes. But in what sense wasn't it the true France?
Not the true France.
All right, one and a half. These were books of stories or successful novels, late 19th century, by Anatole France. And, of course, they were written in French and in France. But Anatole France was only a pseudonym of a chap called Jacques Anatole Thibault. So, in that sense, it wasn't the real France. Dennis Norden, what's the difference between a masculine rhyme and a feminine rhyme? And if you'd like to submit me a coloured diagram afterwards, I don't mind.
Feminine rhyme tends to be cleaner. But in the strict sense... Wait a minute. I'll give you an example, I think. Wait a minute, just let me... hastily... Yes. Ogden Nash wrote, "The turtle lives 'twixt plated decks which practically conceal its sex." Now... Dex and sex is a masculine rhyme because it's monosyllabic. And it goes on, "I think it clever of the turtle in such a fix to be so fertile."
Yes.
Now, turtle and fertile are feminine rhymes because the last syllable doesn't rhyme. The actual rhyme comes before the last syllable.
Well done, Dennis.
Oh,
again.
Really fun.
Sex
of
the turtle.
Also known as strong rhymes and weak rhymes,
yes,
unless you're writing them, because it's the weak rhymes which are the most difficult to do.
Well, we give Dennis 2.5 again, both because he knew absolutely everything about it and also for such an admirable example. In other words, where the rhyme falls on the last syllable of the line, which is stressed, that's masculine. For the feminine rhyme, it's where the unstressed syllable comes last of all, and it's the stressed one just before it. "If he were fatter, 'twould be no matter." That's a feminine one. And we come to the last round and go back to those quotations I gave the two teams earlier in the program. For 2 marks, and Scott James, can you give me the origin of your quotation, "Forever Amber"?
Well, it was the title of a novel which was people always used to keep in a brown paper cover. Tucked in the shelf behind the Dickenses by Kathleen Windsor.
Yes, 2 marks it is. Kathleen Windsor's historical, or I think historical, novel, "Forever Amber." Dennis Powell, the origin of your quotation, "My love is like a red, red rose."
It's the first line of a poem by Burns.
Yep, 2 marks. And now I'm going to ask Dennis and Frank to give me their explanation of how these quotations came into being. And on this occasion, the marks will go to whichever incredible explanation gets the longer applause from the audience here in the theatre. So first of all, back to Dennis Norden and his quotation, Forever Amber.
As a film writer, I can reveal to you that only once have I had an idea for a film that really fired me. It was a different type of war film, because it's a war film that takes place in peacetime. You see, every war film has the same sort of story. It's about a company of Marines or an army platoon or a squadron in the Air Force, a group of individuals who, under the stress of combat and danger, are finally welded into one disciplined unit. You see, and that's the appeal of it. And they've never been able to transfer this to peacetime, because they've never been able to find a similar group under similar stress. But I have a formation dancing team. And my idea is to present the story of a formation dancing team in the terms of a war film. So you start off 20 years back, you see, and there they are. Mrs. Eva Swathney's formation dancing team. 9 men, 9 women. And there, in front of them, and you hear very faintly the Dam Busters cha-cha, is the skipper, Mrs. Eva Swathney. And she says, I'm going to make dancers out of you if it takes 5 years. And we see them follow him in the training, you know, mile after mile, in strict foxtrot tempo, you know, with 250 yards of sequins on their back, and all the hazards, that they, the pitiful shortage of equipment. The girls haven't got enough material to make their frocks. All right, one of them says, give us the tulle and we will finish the job. And then you take them into their first campaign. We see their reverses. And not only their reverses, we see their chassis turns and their scissor step. And then finally, when they're all welded together into one disciplined dancing team, the big moment, they meet the Germans. It's the Eurovision professional dancing tournament, you see, and the tenseness of the waiting beforehand in the dressing room. And finally we come into the closing moments, the Latin American section, and suddenly the murmur goes round. Mrs. Eva Swathney has slipped on an orangeade straw. Eva's bought it. And for a moment they falter. That great heart that led them has stopped. She's in the great palais in the sky. And then our hero, he rallies them. He says, all right, chaps, let's get this one for the skipper. And they sweep in and they win the whole of the Latin American section. I think, you know, and I say this in all modesty, that this is going to make All Quiet on the Western Front look like Mary Poppins. And all I'm held up for at the moment, apart from the fact that everybody thinks it's rotten, is a title. And, you know, I've thought of, considered the 39 steps in which we swerve. But I think I've got it. One that captures the mood of that last tense screen classic, that last Latin American moment. Watch for it when it comes round to your cinemas, because it's our hero's rallying cry. For Eva, Samba.
I'm terribly grateful to Dennis. I've always wanted to know what formation dancing was, and now I do. Well, now we go back to Frank Muir, and if you remember, his quotation was, "My love is like a red, red rose."
Jimmy Young, the disc jockey, are you listening? Because this story I'm telling is really for you. I must explain that Jimmy Young has a radio program, a sort of disc jockey program, and they also give recipes. I've always been fascinated about these recipes, and he gives a recipe and asks listeners to please tell him how they've turned out. Well, I tried one, you see, so, Jimmy, if you're listening, I thought you'd like to know how it turned out. It was, as I recall, most insistent on this, 2 pounds of plain flour. Now, fortunately, I live near the airport, so I was able to go along there on my way home. Do you know that they don't actually bake in the aircraft? You know those stone-cold sandwiches you get sometimes? But they're not actually made in the aircraft. They're made outside and brought in. So I bought some stuff called self-raising flour, which is obviously plain self-raising, the same kind of thing. And there was a pint of water. That was a bit difficult. All I got was a quart bottle. So I very cleverly went to the pub and asked for a pint of beer. I drank that and asked if he'd fill it up with water so that I could wash the glass for him. And I secretly poured that into the quart bottle. Came about halfway up. Then he said, salt, a pinch. Well, that was easy because the window next door was open, the kitchen window. And a lump of yeast, which he said you can get from any baker. Now, I asked the only baker. He actually repairs bicycles. I don't know why Jimmy Young thinks he keeps yeast. And asked him for yeast. He hadn't got any, but I did get some from a cake shop. It's sort of yellow dough and stinks. And I put all the ingredients in the bowl, and it said, mix them all together, pour in the water, and knead for 20 minutes. Now, a couple of hints here. Roll your trousers up first. Or if you started a job and forgotten to roll your trousers up, if you can't get the dough off with hot water or petrol, quite a good tip is to burn the trousers. I needed it for the 20 minutes. It then said find a warm place, about 80 degrees, and put the bowl in to prove it. I shoved the bowl. I didn't seem to prove anything to me, so I took it out again. Well, it was 80 or 20. I stared at it, didn't do anything. Batter just sat there looking at me. So I whipped it out again. It then said, grease a tin. Well, no problem there. Out the garage, back. Put the batter in, press it firmly, and bake in a low oven for about 4 hours. Bit of a problem here. But luckily, the stove has legs. Hacksaw. In quarter an hour, oven quite low, touching the floor, actually, and baked it for 4 hours. Well, I took it out, Jimmy, and it didn't look very prepossessing. I couldn't get it out of the tin. It was a sort of darkish, hard-looking thing. So I inserted a knife down the side of the tin and put all my pressure on the end of the knife, and the loaf disappeared. I couldn't find it anywhere. I searched around, it wasn't in. But the following morning, I found it was on the ceiling, where it had sort of broken the crust, and the dough stuff had started to drop and had congealed into a sort of upside-down, horrible, strange pyramid. Rather like those plaster ceiling fixtures that used to have flecks with a lamp. And that was the result of my thing. So, Jimmy, if you're worrying how my loaf-making turned out, all I can say is, my loaf is like a weird, weird rose.
By your vote, very, very, very close indeed, Frank wins the contest of the two stories. And so far as the contest as a whole is concerned, this means a win for Phyllis Pau and Frank Muir by 2 marks. And that also brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Phyllis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norton, introduced by Jack Longland. The program was devised by Tony Schreien and Edward J. Mason, and presented by the BBC. Thank you.